givers to look at privacy policies and find out what kind of information and data is being gathered and shared. Murray says despite toys being potentially harmful, they still remain available. One of those toys is called water beads, colorful, squishy sensory toys the size of pinheads or ice cream sprinkles. They expand when placed in water. If ingested, the beads expand and can block a child's airway or damage the digestive tract.
Congress just introduced legislation a couple of weeks ago to ban water beads as toys, and the Consumer Product Safety Commission has indicated that they're going to put some kind of restrictions on water beads.
Murray recommends that if you do have water beads in your home, especially if you have a child or pet, get rid of them. You can make sure toys you buy or that your child already has are safe by following tips at toyssafetytips.org. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
You're listening to an end-of-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 14th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Gina Carey, Suzanne Potter, and Alex Gonzalez. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Full Omath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. Thanks so much for listening. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year campaign, so now's a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. Israel, the U.S., and their fight over Gaza. The European Union seeks to rein in artificial intelligence. And China's growing power in space. Israel, the U.S., and their fight over Gaza. There are actually two wars going on over Gaza. Besides the Israeli-Hamas war, we have the U.S.-Israeli plans for Gaza's political future. Here's the American plan, which was first made public following the G7 meeting in Tokyo on November 8. Secretary of State Blinken said, quote, "The U.S. believes key elements should include no forcible displacement of Palestinians from Gaza, not now, not after the war. No use of Gaza as a platform for terrorism or other violent attacks. No reoccupation of Gaza after the conflict ends. No attempt to blockade or besiege Gaza. No reduction in the territory of Gaza. We must also ensure no terrorist threats can emanate from the West Bank," unquote. On Gaza's governance after the war, Blinken is reported to have said it, quote, "must include Palestinian-led governance and Gaza unified with the West Bank under the Palestinian Authority, and it must include a sustained mechanism for reconstruction in Gaza and a pathway to Israelis and Palestinians living side by side in states of their own, with equal measures of security, freedom, opportunity, and dignity," unquote. Prime Minister Netanyahu's stance is equally firm and was repeated just a few days ago. Israeli reoccupation of Gaza for the, quote, "indefinite future," the Palestinian Authority will have no role, period. Thomas Friedman of the New York Times quotes a recent speech in which Netanyahu offers a withering criticism of the Palestinian Authority, saying it is, quote, "a civil authority that educates its children to hate Israel, to kill Israelis, to eliminate the state of Israel, an authority that pays the families of murderers based on the number they murdered, an authority whose leader still has not condemned the terrible massacre." Not that the U.S. plan is without flaws. It would give power to an entity, the PA, that is deeply unpopular in the West Bank, let alone Gaza, where it lost authority to Hamas in 2007. The PA under Mahmoud Abbas is a corrupt organization which, like Hamas, hasn't held an election in ages. Would it hold one in Gaza? Even the State Department regards its own plan as the best among poor alternatives. We're stuck, Politico quotes one State Department official. There's a strong policy preference for the PA to play a governing role in Gaza, but it has significant legitimacy and capability challenges. Neither Blinken's outline nor Israeli planning gets to the heart of the matter. Governing Gaza on behalf of the Palestinian people requires grassroots support and the development of civil society. To some, international involvement will also be needed, particularly for security and humanitarian aid. The Saudis have floated the idea of an international force, which might be composed of UN peacekeepers or soldiers from Middle East countries. But Hamas will still be around, posing a constant challenge to Israeli authority. As one scholar reminds us, Hamas has used the war to establish its place not just as defender of Gaza, but also as standard bearer of Palestinian liberation. For all the talk about Gaza's future, its present requires the most urgent attention. Gaza is a complete humanitarian disaster. Over 17,000 people have been killed. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres took the unusual step last week of invoking Article 99 of the UN Charter to bring Gaza's condition before the Security Council. The UN official in charge of Gaza says, "Civil order is breaking down in Gaza. The streets feel wild, particularly after dark. Some aid convoys are being looted and UN vehicles stoned. Society is on the brink of full-blown collapse." "The aid system is in tatters," says another UN official on the scene. "If Gaza were a country, it would be considered a failed state, requiring the UN membership to respond under the Responsibility to Protect resolution." The Biden administration, while rejecting a ceasefire called for at the UN, cannot convince Netanyahu that Israel should do more to respect civilian rights in Gaza. The president and Blinken time and again appeal for more care in Israeli targeting, but to no avail. Last week, for instance, Biden called Netanyahu to emphasize Gaza's need of more humanitarian assistance and to urge that corridors be established for civilians to escape the fighting. Blinken diplomatically criticized Israel for the, quote, gap between Israel's promise to protect civilians and the actual results that we're seeing on the ground. And Biden, just the other day, warned Netanyahu that Israel is losing international support because of civilian casualties in Gaza. But Netanyahu is confident the U.S. will not go beyond appeals for restraint. To the contrary, he knows he can rely on the U.S. to continue providing the very weapons Israel is using to decimate Gaza. That's really all he wants from the United States, as he reportedly said in a leaked remark to aides. "Weapons, weapons, and more weapons," he said. And he's getting them. Citing estimates of damage to urban areas, military analysts say the destruction of northern Gaza in less than 7 weeks has approached that caused by the years-long carpet bombing of German cities during the Second World War. Dresden, Hamburg, Cologne, some of the world's heaviest ever bombings are remembered by their place names, said Robert Pape, a U.S. military historian and author of Bombing to Win, a landmark survey of 20th century bombing campaigns. Quote, "Gaza will also go down as a place name denoting one of the history's heaviest conventional bombing campaigns. Israel's weapons, such as precision-guided 2,000-pound bombs, are far more destructive than anything deployed against German cities, accounting for the scale of the destruction and the loss of life." The European Union seeks to rein in artificial intelligence. The EU Parliament has drafted an AI Act that attempts to gain some control over how AI is used and abused. The act seems very commonsensical. It restricts use of AI by companies and governments in high-risk areas, such as law enforcement and the operation of crucial services, like water and energy. Chatbots and software that create manipulated images, such as deepfakes, would have to make clear that what people were seeing was generated by AI. Makers of such generative AI, the New York Times reports, quote, would also have to put safeguards in place to prevent them from generating illegal content, unquote. Restrictions are also imposed on use of facial recognition technology, such as by police forces. The European approach to AI focuses on risks in application. This differs from the U.S. approach, which for now focuses on privacy rights, and the Chinese approach, which requires that AI conform with state censorship rules. The EU law still must pass final approval by the parliaments of all 27 members of the European Union. It will not take effect for 1 to 2 years, however, by which time AI will probably have advanced a great deal, rendering parts of the new law obsolete. China's growing space power. China is fast becoming a space power, potentially adding measurably to its expanding military capabilities. It now has around 700 satellites in orbit, and these are in communication with a global network of space stations, most recently in Latin America. As the Washington Post reports, quote, apart from two ground stations in Bolivia opened in 2013, China built space facilities in Venezuela in 2008, Peru in 2015, Argentina in 2016, and has at least two stations under construction in Antarctica. It has additional access to facilities in Brazil and Chile through research partnerships, unquote. The stations do serve legitimate commercial purposes, such as facilitating internet services and tracking all vehicles in space. The Pentagon, however, sees the potential for military uses, since the Chinese system presumably can do what the American system does, namely survey the other side's missile launches and possibly jam or destroy its satellites. Moreover, as the Washington Post article notes, quote, what sets China's international commercial space program apart is its close links to the military. The contractors behind China's space technology, including most of the Latin American and Antarctic facilities, are also the leading state-owned powerhouses behind the missile development, cyber warfare, and counter-space defense programs of the People's Liberation Army. The U.S.-China space competition extends to outer space. Both countries are working toward building a long-term presence on the moon and in the real estate between the moon and Earth. A specialist with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington says of the importance of getting there first, quote, we want to be there establishing precedent for mining of materials on the moon and how that's done for making claims to materials and property rights. We want to do that in a way that's consistent with our values and our economic system. And if China gets there first, they will get to set precedent that's based on their values and their economic system. In short, there's a lot more to U.S.-China competition than conflict in Asia. In other news, a wider war in the Middle East, conflict in the Red Sea and on the Lebanon border. The Iran-backed force in Yemen, the Houthis, have been firing on commercial ships in the Red Sea and on targets in Israel, posing a problem for the U.S. as to how to respond. The Houthis are essentially acting as proxies for Iran, which has avoided direct conflict in the Israel-Hamas war. Saudi Arabia, recognizing the potential for a widening of the war, has urged restraint on the U.S. in reacting to Houthi attacks. The Saudis have much at stake. It has finally normalized relations with Iran, and after several years of aligning with the officially recognized Yemeni government against the Houthis, has been trying to reach a peace agreement with them. Some Pentagon officials reportedly want to take on the Houthis, which have a considerable arsenal of missiles and drones. Meanwhile, on the Lebanese border, the prospect is increasing that Israel will carry the war to Hezbollah, unless the Lebanese government and Iran do something to restrain Hezbollah. On a visit to troops at the border, Israel's chief of staff said a very clear change may have to be made to ensure security. Quote, both in the south and in the north, first we need to return to a different situation and return both safety and a sense of security, unquote. Like the Houthis, Hezbollah has been attacking Israel with missiles and drones in support of Hamas. A $600 billion Trans-Africa Railway Project. The West's answer to China's trillion-dollar Belt and Road Initiative has now been uncovered. It's a $600 billion east-west railway that will run across the heart of Africa, connecting the Angolan port of Lobito on the west coast with the Democratic Republic of Congo in the middle of Africa and then Zambia on the east coast. The Trans-Africa Railway Project is a joint one of the G7 group of major economies, the Africa Development Bank, and the Africa Finance Corporation. The U.S. State Department describes the project as, quote, the most significant transport infrastructure that the U.S. has helped develop on the African continent in a generation, and will enhance regional trade and growth, as well as advance the shared vision of connected, open-access rail from the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean, unquote. Left unsaid is that the main purpose of the project, which includes hundreds of miles of roads as well as tracks, is to access mineral resources along the route. Whether that's really a contribution to Africa's development is up for debate. In any case, the project is slated to be completed by 2027. White hydrogen, a potential answer to global warming. White or pure hydrogen could be the clean energy that moves us away from fossil fuels. A major finding in abandoned coal fields of northern France is exciting energy experts far and wide. It's not the first experimental drilling for hydrogen. Drilling is also occurring in Australia and parts of the US and Europe. The French hydrogen field required drilling a half mile into rock, suggesting not only what it will take to obtain large quantities of pure hydrogen, but also raising concerns about fossil fuel that will be needed to power the drilling equipment. And there's the rub: the expense, time, and especially energy needed to get energy. Finally, Trump resumes his war on Muslims. Donald Trump says he'll implement a religious test for immigrants if he's elected. Quote, "If you don't like our religion, then we don't want you in our country," he said at a rally. He revived his call from 2017 for banning immigration from certain Middle East countries. It is hardly coincidental that Trump's railings come at a time of sharply rising anti-Muslim sentiment and violence in the U.S. and abroad, nearly equal to the rise of anti-Semitism since October 7. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. On the show today, I'm speaking with Tom Hartman, progressive radio host and author of the new book, The Hidden History of American Democracy, Rediscovering Humanity's Ancient Way of Living. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Hey, Althea. Thanks for inviting me back.
Glad you can be with us to discuss your new book. So this newest edition in your Hidden History series starts with the assertion that democracy is ours, humans' natural state. Can you break down that idea for us?
To enlarge the aperture even more, it is the natural state of virtually all animals. Back 10, 15 years ago, a couple of scientists in the UK, Roper and Conrad, published a piece in Science hypothesizing that the mythology that we have had for centuries, that alpha animals were decision makers in their communities, would be demonstrated to be wrong, and that in fact most decisions would be made democratically by majority rule in virtually all animal communities, because that was the optimal way to ensure the survival of a species, to have the best decision making possible. And then Randerson, did a trial test on this, where they had, at the University of Essex, they had a forest nearby with a bunch of red deer in it, a herd of red deer. And there were three watering holes, and they put cameras in the trees to follow the deer to see, you know, when did they decide to go to which watering hole and how did they make the decision. And what they found was, you know, first of all, there are alpha animals among red deer, but as Conrad and Roper had predicted, they had first choice of sexual partners, you know, to pass along the strongest genes. But that was it. That was the only area where anybody paid any attention to them. Secondly, what they found was that when over 50% of the deer were pointing their bodies at one of the three particular watering holes, then within a matter of minutes, the entire herd would organize itself and head right to that watering hole. Now, in our Constitution, we require two-thirds of a majority for really serious things, like amending the Constitution requires two-thirds of the House and Senate. And so they put a predator by the watering holes, by each of the watering holes, to see what would happen when the stakes were raised. And what happened was the deer had to hit a two-thirds majority before they would all go to the watering hole. And, you know, which is pretty amazing. I mean, this is part of us. This is, you know, nature. And so I called up Kent Conrad, one of the two scientists who published this, and said, you know, what happened when you published this? And he said, well, we found that the bird guy called and said, you know, this is flock behavior. When a flock of birds is going across the sky and they suddenly make a right turn, it's because 51% of the birds, you know, they're voting with every wing beat. They voted to move. Same thing with fish and schooling behavior. They're seeing it with the balls of gnats flying in the air. You know, it's the default mode for all animals, or all social animals, which is well over 90% of all animals. So then you look at humanity, and the human societies that have evolved over, you know, a period of tens or hundreds of thousands of years, what we call Aboriginal indigenous societies, they're not all democratic, but the vast majority are. And the ones that are democratic are the most resilient. There was a piece just last week published in Nature about this, where they were looking at, in Mesoamerica, they're doing deep archaeology, looking at these old cities that have been unoccupied for, you know, hundreds of years, but were around for thousands of years. And what they found was that in many of these cities, there's no evidence of great wealth, there's no evidence of poverty, and it looks like those cities and communities were the most resilient compared to their dictatorial neighbors, where, you know, somebody had risen up and said, I'm the one who knows how to talk to the sky god, or I'm the one who's got the perfect genes or whatever, or I'm the warlord who can, you know, kick your butts. And so, you know, this is a pretty clear thing. Also, the other thing I discovered when I was researching the book is that the founders essentially knew this and believed it to be true. They didn't think that they were doing something weird. They thought that Europe had been getting it wrong for years and years. Jefferson in particular was a big fan of the Whig histories. Paul de Ripon de Terrasse wrote a book in the early 1700s called The History of England, which was about England before the Roman invasion in the, I think it's around 150 BC. And before that, the people in Britain were living tribally, and they were red-haired people by and large, and Jefferson was red-haired, so he was kind of obsessed with that. But they had these very egalitarian, very small d democratic political systems, according to Terrasse. Jefferson believed it, as did most of his peers, and so when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, he wrote in, you know, he was talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that this was the goal of nature's God. And John Adams, when he edited the Declaration, scratched out nature's God and wrote in the Christian God, and Jefferson got that back and scratched out the Christian God and put in nature's God. And to this day, in the Declaration of Independence, it says nature's God. That was the only God that they were willing to recognize. So it's democracy.
Well, you touched on this a little bit, but obviously a lot has been said about where the framers got their ideas for representative democracy, and it's often been traced back to ancient Greece and Rome, but that's not the full story. You write that Native Americans were influential in their thinking. What role did they play?
That's right. Yeah, the story that we're all told in you know, elementary school civics or junior high school civics, that the American Republic was based on the Roman Republic and the Greek democracy, is just not true. We're profoundly different from the Greek democracy. It was closer to a pure democracy, and it got corrupted fairly quickly. And the Roman Republic had, other than having a body called the Senate, had very little resemblance to the United States form of government. Nowadays, rather than making that kind of glib assertion, you know, Rome and Greece, most people say, well, you know, they got their ideas, the founders and the framers got their ideas from the British and French Enlightenment thinkers, you know, from Hobbes and Locke and Montesquieu and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and like that. And yeah, they certainly quoted those people a lot, but that raises the question, where do those people get the idea from? And it turns out that from the early 1700s through the mid to late 1700s, these French priests who had accompanied the French trappers, who had penetrated deeply into the eastern Midwest, into what's now western New York State and northern Indiana and Ohio and parts of Michigan, where there was a lot of pelt, you know, a lot of beavers to trap and things. These French missionaries, Jesuit missionaries, actually were accepted by the Huron tribe, where they kind of set up shop, and then every year they would write this summary of their experiences, and these were major bestsellers in France, and they were published in multiple languages across Europe. And what they were describing were these very, very democratic societies. So by the 1720s, 1730s, there was this huge hunger in Europe, and particularly in France, to talk to these Indians. And the French had taught a lot of the Hurons French. And so some of the Huron leaders started traveling to France. And there was this big fad going on at the time of mostly wealthy women holding of high, you know, social class, holding salons in their homes. And they would invite a famous speaker. Jefferson and Franklin were frequent guests at these salons. And so there were several of these Native Americans who went to France and basically evangelized for democracy, for the kind of democracy that the Iroquois Confederacy had. And so we know, for example, that John Locke actually attended one of these. We know that Voltaire attended one. We know that Rousseau was knowledgeable of them, as was Denis Diderot. So they kind of took the ideas from North America's Native Americans and synthesized them as essentially their own, and then got quoted by the founders. Now, the founders also, many of them, were very close to the Native American societies. So it was really, the American experiment is based on a 10,000-year-long trial and error experience that these Native American communities had here in North America to finally develop or perfect something that, you know, would work as a way of living together. And, you know, as Franklin wrote famously, you know, he pointed out that they have no prisons, they have no jails, they have no police, and yet they live in harmony. He said, it should be an amazing thing if five nations of ignorant savages have been able to forge a bond that has lasted in peace for a millennia, and 13 colonies of educated Englishmen can't do the same. And you know, so that's how they were thinking, and that's where it came from.
Your book also, in part four, gives some action items for taking lessons from this hidden history and putting them into action. I want to touch on maybe one or two since we have the time. One of them that I maybe a new addition to your books here, and I'd love to get your thoughts on, is this idea of expanding the Senate.
Yeah, the Senate has been expanded by states being brought into the Union on multiple occasions, every single time by a Republican president who wanted more Republican senators. And in both cases, in essentially violation of the standards at the time. For example, in the 1860s, Abraham Lincoln needed another two Republican senators. And the Nevada Territory only had about 7,000 people in it. And I think, if I'm remembering right, it's in the book, it took around 39,000 people at that time to justify one member of the House of Representatives, which was the threshold for statehood. But Lincoln brought it into the Union anyway because he wanted those two senators. Benjamin Harrison did the same thing with the Dakota Territory. The entire Dakota Territory barely qualified as a single state, but he split it into two because he needed four Republican senators. So this has been done repeatedly, and frankly, Democrats need to get in on the game. We should make D.C. and Puerto Rico states. Right now, we've got 50 Republican and 50 Democratic senators in the Senate, and yet the Democratic senators represent 41 million more people than do the Republican senators. That's not small D Democratic. It's not healthy. And by adding, at the very least, adding D.C. and Puerto Rico, that would be about 5.5 million people. So then the Democratic senators only represent 35 million more people than the Republicans. And frankly, I think, you know, adding the U.S. Virgin Islands as a state, adding, you know, Guam and the Solomon Islands and, you know, those Pacific Islands as a state, I would even go that far. I think we could add as many as five states that would end up largely voting Democratic. And the Senate would still tilt toward Republican representation.
Another one of these fixes that you propose is making voting a right instead of a privilege. And just off that headline, I thought it was a right.
It's not, sadly. In fact, the Bush v. Gore case, where the Supreme Court decided who would become president in 2000, William Rehnquist, in his majority decision, wrote that there is no explicit right to vote for president of the United States in the Constitution. The Constitution does use the word right a lot in the same sentence with the word voting in reference to black people in the 15th Amendment, with regard to women in the 20th Amendment, I believe, and with regard to students in the 27th Amendment, if I'm recalling correctly, the one that lowered the voting age to 18. But those are all specific groups. There's no universal right to vote. I think you could easily read it into the Constitution. And in 1993, with the motor voter law Congress passed, it says both in the preamble and in the black text law of the body of the law itself that voting is a right in the United States. But it's never been adjudicated by the Supreme Court. In fact, the opposite was the case with Bush v. Gore. And so, you know, we need to have a law that amplifies the Motor Voter Act that explicitly says that it's a right, and it needs to be subject to judicial review. And if that were to happen, then, the For the People Act, which incorporated the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, said that voting was a right. And, would have gone a long way in that direction. The problem is that even though it passed the House of Representatives and it had 51 votes in the Senate, which is enough to pass, it faced a unified Republican filibuster, and Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema refused.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development and Events Committee will be held on Monday, December 18th at 4:30 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.